Variant classification and interpretation have become important skills for genetic counselors, but it takes so long, even if it's just a VUS you want to double check. To make it streamlined, check out franklin.genox.com/DNA today. You can access so much information about a variant, including relevant publications, automated ACMG classifications, annotations, and phenotypes disease. Best part? It's free. Just go to franklin.genox.com/DNA today, and all this data about one variant is compiled at your fingertips. No more sifting through PubMed. Join the future of variant interpretation.
How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.
Hello, you're listening to DNA Today, a genetics podcast and radio show. I'm your host, Kira Tadeen. On this show, I explore genetics and how it impacts our health through conversations with leaders in genetics, such as genetic counselors, researchers, doctors, and patient advocates. My guest today is Sam Toy, who is a pediatric genetic counselor at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. She earned her BS in biology and MS in professional biology from Indiana University. She then went on to earn her MS in genetic counseling from Indiana State University. So thank you so much, Sam, for coming on the show. I'm really excited to jump into this episode because I have not talked about pediatric genetic counseling on the show, really.
Hi, Kira. It's nice to meet you and talk about one of my favorite specialties.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. And it's really exciting that we're able to jump into this topic. And I'm sure a lot of people know about genetic counselors, by now, if you're listening to the show. But for those that don't know, genetic counselors are helping patients and the population understand their genetics to make informed healthcare decisions. And the area that you work in is in pediatric genetic counseling. How is that role specific, like in pediatric genetic counseling, of the specialty you're in versus just genetic counselors in general?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So pediatric genetic counselors really focus on that specialty of working with children and in a larger picture with families to find out whether or not they have a genetic condition or if they've already been diagnosed with a condition, either learning more about it or helping with the management of that.
And so for people that are possibly either thinking about genetic counseling going into the specialty or on the flip side of parents with a child that maybe they're going to see a pediatric genetic counselor, how can you prepare them? Like, what does a typical session look like? What can they expect?
Yeah, so for a particular I guess it would depend on the type of clinic. So I think in general, the field of pediatric genetic counseling can vary by the type of clinic. For me, we typically have a genetic counselor meet first with the family, and we talk about the medical history. So collecting things like, you know, has this patient had any surgeries or hospitalizations? Talking about developmental milestones, especially if we're concerned about things like developmental delays, and also gathering family history as well. So kind of a typical session at first will be a lot of intake, so trying to get a good picture of what's been going on. Then usually the next component is having a geneticist coming in to do a medical evaluation. And then at that point, we're able to kind of take all these different pieces together and decide whether or not we would have any recommendations of either doing genetic testing, or if they're coming in to have kind of more of a counseling visit, we'll have the genetic counselor kind of come in and talk about genetic testing results.
So that's a pretty good snapshot in showing that in pediatrics, often the genetic counselor is working very closely with the doctor and the physician. And for people that may not know, when you're talking about family history, so maybe someone's preparing of information they should be bringing into a session, what are the types of questions you ask, say, in pediatric that maybe we're not asking in cancer and prenatal and cardiac? What's more specific that you're looking at from that pediatric scope?
So I think a family history can be kind of more tailored towards maybe the indication that the family is coming in for, not tailored in the way maybe like a cancer setting is, where we're really kind of focusing more on, you know, what cancers are in a family history. But let's say that someone is coming in with a family history of epilepsy. While I'm still going to try to be gathering kind of pertinent information about the, you know, the three generations, I'm going to be asking and maybe focusing more on, you know, do we see anyone who's had epilepsy in the past, or kind of tailoring a session that way.
And is there anything that you find specifically different about the pediatric specialty compared to these other specialties that I'm mentioning? And there are so many, so I can't mention them all, but is there anything that you find unique that maybe brought you into the field? You're like, this is why I like pediatrics, or this is what kind of distinguishes it from the rest of the specialties in genetic counseling?
Yeah. So the two things that kind of jump out to me, the first thing is something that you kind of touched on already, is that collaboration side. So in general, genetic counselors in the peds world don't work alone. So on a daily basis, I'm working really closely with our medical geneticists, nurse practitioners, metabolic dietitians in my department. So kind of when we were talking about that typical session, I'm not the only person that family will be meeting with that day. We all sit down, you know, a week before and decide, you know, what are the specialists that each family needs to be seen with. So let's say a patient that was coming in maybe with PKU and was a new diagnosis, they might not just meet with me to talk about that genetic counseling component, but they might also be meeting with, let's say, that medical dietitian, as well as meeting with that with the geneticist as well. So I think this field, the peds field, is definitely more on the collaborative side, on more of a daily basis, and how that appointment will look.
And it's really great because the patients get to have more of that comprehensive care of, especially when it sounds like, you know, the clinic that you're in, being able to work so closely with the doctors that you're not saying, okay, tell me about the appointments you've had. Great. I'm going to do my part. Good luck seeing your next doctor. It sounds very integrated. And that's something that I think I hear most from pediatric genetic counselors, is they work so closely with doctors. Whereas in other fields, sometimes prenatal, I've seen that a little bit, but I think in cancer, you're very like, the patient is coming in talking to you, and you may know the doctors they're talking about, and hopefully you do, but you're not directly working with them every day and like, oh, okay, I just saw this patient, you're about to see them. A lot of that communication and the great aspect of you being a genetic counselor, you having your knowledge and skill set, and having that complement with the doctor of having their own skill set of, if one of you can't answer a question for the patient, probably the other one can.
Absolutely. I think that's probably one of the more, one of the strong suits about peds, is that, you know, we see indications across the board. So our ability to sit down kind of as a team to, you know, if we get a variant of uncertain significance and we have multiple eyes kind of looking at this, coming from different directions, and then being able to communicate those results in different ways is also helpful as well, since genetic counselors have that, you know, that training to help communicate results to families.
And that can be one of the trickiest parts, especially a VUS, you mentioned, of a variant unknown significance or uncertain significance, where we find something and we don't really know what it means. And so that can be a challenge to talk, and it's great when multiple people can be involved in that process so that patients really understand what that means and what the implications are for their health. How do you get patients into your clinic? How are they usually referred? Is it like from a general practitioner? Is it like specialists from newborn screening? I'm sure it's probably a variety.
So I think we get referrals in multiple different directions. I think you hit on some of the more common ways. So we get specialists who will see a patient, and let's say they had a long QT interval and several families that have had sudden collapses, you know, that they might refer that patient to genetics to be referred for, you know, possibly having that and looking for long QT with genetic testing. Another way that you had mentioned is by, you know, kind of their primary care physician or the pediatrician noticing that maybe this child isn't reaching their developmental milestones like they need to, or there may be failure to thrive. And another way is, let's say a specialist has already started that genetic testing process. So they've already, like, let's say a neurologist had ordered an epilepsy panel and they had gotten one of those variants of uncertain significance and they're not sure where to go at that point. We can often get referrals that way as well.
So they're coming from a lot of different places. And I think one of the more challenging aspects that it sounds like for pediatric is that it's not like you're in a field where you really know certain conditions and you're like, great, this is what I'm seeing. Pediatric, you're seeing such a wide variety of different conditions. That being said, are there some that are more common disorders that you're like, yes, we see like a good amount of, you know, this type of disorder on a monthly basis, or am I off and it's really just so many different, more rare diseases?
So I don't think I could really pick out a particular disorder that we see kind of more often. I will say that, you know, exome sequencing has definitely changed the game, where we used to maybe before exome sequencing, we would be able to sit down and say, yes, like we see typically X, Y, and Z quite often. I feel like with exome sequencing, I will open up a result and it just says like a brand new gene name that's a candidate gene, kind of like, let's say like TUB 1A gene related disorder, and it doesn't even have a specific name to it yet. And then you end up having to research about that particular rare gene that you've probably never seen before. So I think we're getting to that point where we're seeing so many different conditions that we've never seen before.
And it's interesting how like the exome has come up, yeah, much more so now than it did in the past. And for those that don't know, when we're talking about an exome test, this is where you are looking at the portion of your genome, so your genetics, that is actually turning into protein directly. So it's looking at that part that's actually like more of the active part of the genome. So when it comes to you were talking about patients coming in, say, with some of these results, but I imagine you're also ordering a lot of this of, you know, either exome, possibly some whole genome, and then some that are like more of a test that's focused on a certain gene instead of all of your genes. How often are you ordering these? Do you tend to just really order like exome at this point? Or are you still doing a lot of those panels that we keep referring to, meaning like multiple genes that are specifically curated?
So I would say that there's been quite a large movement towards ordering exome more often. Some of the reasons why we might, you know, jump to exome instead of maybe going to those panels that you mentioned, is if we're seeing symptoms in multiple different kind of organ systems, where you know, jumping and doing panels might take longer in that diagnostic journey or that diagnostic odyssey, where, you know, if someone's presenting with epilepsy and also, let's say, intellectual disability or renal problems, it might be better that we jump straight to exome for cost effectiveness. And also we have a greater amount of yield with exome sequencing. So for that reason, we are seeing exome being ordered more often, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we don't use those gene panels like you talked about.
I imagine in the future it may start to go more towards exome as we learn much more about these variants. Because if we're getting a lot of those VUSs right now, that's not as helpful. But as we learn more of these genes and how they're implicated into health conditions, it's probably going to get easier. But you must have a lot of results that you don't find an answer. So it may be a negative or you're finding a VUS. How is this with patients? Of if a patient's received like many negatives in a row, how do you handle this? How does the psych portion of the session go of like, you know, we're still not able to find something? Is there a certain approach you take with those patients?
Yeah, I think giving out negative results to a family, especially in kind of the peds world, it's very difficult. I definitely thought walking in that, you know, you'd think that there would be more hardship and maybe more difficulty with giving out positive results. But with negative results, you're dealing with a lot of frustration, I feel, on the family's part, where they've gone through, like you said, having several tests done and just being frustrated by the fact that we're either getting those negatives or, you know, possible variants of uncertain significance. And I think our training on that psychosocial skills definitely come into play at that point. And being willing to kind of listen to family frustrations. When we do get, let's say, those negative exome results, a lot of the times we will kind of make sure that we recontact that family in, we set an arbitrary kind of 2-year timeline. That way we're able to kind of go back and reanalyze those results and see whether or not there's been any additional findings or any reclassifications that were found on the original exome. So sometimes that's something that we're able to give families. And also I feel like negative results are also confusing to a family as well. I've had a lot of families ask, well, if we had negative test results, does that mean that my child doesn't have, you know, a genetic condition? So another aspect of our training is being able to help families understand, you know, just because we have a negative test result does not necessarily mean that we can rule out that there's not a genetic cause. And I think that's something really important for families to understand, especially when they've had maybe testing done, like, let's say, a microarray, and understanding that, you know, with this particular test, we're not able to pick up anything genetic, but, you know, we're only picking up bits and pieces of extra missing chromosomal material, and this does not rule out a genetic cause. So I think having families understand negative results is just as important as being able to understand those positive results.
I think that's a really, really good point, in that I've heard some genetic counselors, I did a rotation in neurogenetics, and so a lot of negatives in that area as well, and that's with patients that have symptoms. So kind of there's a lot of similarities there. And the genetic counselor I was working with would often use the term uninformed. So, you know, our results are not informative. We didn't find anything that we can say, this is what is causing the symptoms you're having. But that doesn't mean they don't have the symptoms. Clinically, they still have those symptoms. It's just we're not finding that cause. And that's great that you're able to really sit down with, you know, patients and their families to explain that concept, because in a lot of other senses of medical care and healthcare, when we have a negative, it's like, oh, you don't have it. Whereas here, genetics is so complicated and there's so many different angles to this. And I imagine a lot of patients also ask, when you're talking about genetic testing and seeing if that's something they want to elect to do, they say, well, what's the point? What is this genetic test going to give me? What extra information can this help, you know, my child or myself? How do you approach that with parents? What kind of information are you able to give after a diagnosis?
Yeah, and I think we do get that question a lot from families asking, you know, what is the benefit with going forward with genetic testing? So some of the things that I'll talk about is that sometimes when we're able to find some sort of genetic cause, sometimes we know that there are other symptoms or that we haven't looked for yet, such as maybe an individual had exome done, and we know that there's been reports of someone having maybe renal problems, and so we would want to be ordering a renal ultrasound for that reason. Another reason is that we're able to kind of have an answer. A lot of families are, you know, going through that diagnostic odyssey because they are trying to determine, you know, is what the genetic cause is. And then another reason is that by having some sort of explanation, we're able to get therapies and services that might not have been offered to that particular child without having some sort of diagnosis. So that's another kind of helpful benefit for testing.
And with that, do you mean insurance-wise, if they have a condition, then their insurance will cover other areas that they need?
Right.
Okay. Yes. So I can imagine that being really helpful in being able to, you know, sometimes having to fight insurance companies to say, this is really necessary. We need, you know, this aspect. And just for if, you know, oftentimes people are like, okay, but tell me about the money aspect. Does insurance typically cover like testing, or is it really case by case and too hard to make a blanket statement?
Yeah. So unfortunately, I think it's hard to make a blanket statement. For genetic testing, I think across the board, when we're attempting to get those prior authorizations or asking insurance companies to pay for testing, some companies are more willing to pay for testing, and we have more difficulty with others. Some require things like a letter of medical necessity, trying to make sure that this test is actually necessary for the management of this particular person. So it would be hard to kind of give a blanket statement. But I think in general, we're seeing more insurance companies covering genetic testing because they're able to see that, you know, in the long run, by doing genetic testing and uncovering the potential, you know, genetic causes, we're able to save money in the long run. So we are seeing some genetic tests getting covered on a more of a regular basis.
Which is fantastic. And I'm sure, you know, patients really like hearing that. And it's a hard enough journey to be going through this diagnostic odyssey of trying to find what is the diagnosis that, you know, my child or myself are experiencing. And so being able to have that be covered to some extent, I'm sure, is really, really helpful. And, you know, we've talked a lot about and kind of mentioned of oftentimes you have, you know, parents or caregivers with a child. Have you experienced any cases where parents and children have had a hard time coming to a decision together with genetic testing of, you know, if the child is, say, a teenager and, you know, parents and child are not seeing eye to eye, they're still a minor. So, you know, parents legally have the decision, I would imagine. You can correct me if I'm wrong there. But how do you handle this as the genetic counselor of being able to maybe facilitate this conversation so that, you know, there is an agreement there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I don't think I've personally had a situation where the adult and the patient haven't quite agreed to have genetic testing. I have had situations where maybe both parents are not on the same page on what they would like to do with testing.
Yeah, that's probably more likely.
Yeah. And so in those situations, I think, you know, we help facilitate discussion, right? So, you know, you can play that mediator role in giving both parents kind of that opportunity to voice, you know, their concerns or what they think about the testing. And I haven't had a session yet where we haven't been able to kind of come with some conclusion, or, you know, by giving them time saying, you know, feel free to call us if you decide that you want testing or decide that you'd like to ask more questions about this, where we haven't been able to kind of come to a decision.
And you kind of mentioned that you're a newer genetic counselor, being a recent grad. What are some of the challenges you faced of, you know, transitioning from grad school and getting your master's to actually practicing, and anything that you kind of wish you could tell yourself like a year ago?
Yeah. So I think jumping into any job is difficult. And I think definitely with genetic counseling, I think just the way that our role is, you're forced to kind of hit the ground running a little bit. I would say that one of the things that I found really helpful was seeking out, you know, mentors or seeking out the genetic counselors that are more experienced and surrounding yourself with that help. So just not being afraid to ask questions, knowing that you are new at this and you don't have all the answers, even though, you know, you've done your clinical rotations, doesn't mean that you know exactly how the authorization insurance process works or kind of that administrative side of things. So I think just being open and flexible to ask questions, and especially if you're a new genetic counselor working alone, seeking out, you know, different ways that you could reach out to more experienced genetic counselors for that help too.
And that's kind of a role we're going to have for a lifetime. We're never going to have all the answers. We're never going to know every single condition out there. And that's kind of what's exciting about genetic counseling, and just that there's always new information to learn and to be pushing yourself. And I think that's a really good tip to reach out to either past supervisors or get to know the genetic counselors in your area if you do a move like yourself, and finding those people that you can go to and just pick up the phone and say, hey, can I, you know, pick your brain on this case? Or, you know, can I take you out to lunch every 2 weeks and just kind of go over some things so that you have some kind of a supervisor that you can go to and be checking in? Because I'm sure, you know, the first year of any kind of job is difficult, but especially in a job like this where, you know, you're expected to know a lot of different information and no case is really the same. You can have some of your more routine cases, but even within that, you're going to have some differences.
Absolutely. And I think having that kind of supportive system in place really helps you, you know, bridge that gap from student into genetic counselor role.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and really giving us a glimpse into pediatric genetics and the experience that you've had. And I'm sure if there are parents listening, that really advantageous for them to hear that just so they kind of have a better sense of maybe what they're walking into, going to pediatric, you know, genetic counseling appointment and maybe information repair. We talked about, you know, medical history and that family history. Some people do a little research and homework with their family history, may call one of their own parents and start gathering that because, you know, a lot of us say family history is the best genetic test we really can do. So it's a good place to start. But thank you so much for coming on and sharing this wealth of knowledge you have.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
You can learn more by going to dnapodcast.com. That is where all of the episodes are housed, and there's over 100 of them from the last 7 years. Lots of information on there that you may not get in the episode, so extra information at dnapodcast.com. And if you're on Twitter, you can follow at dnapodcast. On Instagram, a little different, at dnaradio. And any questions you have for myself or Sam, you can send into info@dnapodcast.com. And we're approaching application deadlines for genetic counseling grad schools. So I wanted to remind listeners that episode 87 has tips from myself and 3 other genetic counseling students on those applications. And then 10 episodes later, episode 97 has advice on the other half of the application process. So interviews, ranks, match. So that's episode 87 is more relevant for those that are applying to schools right now. And next week is Thanksgiving in the U.S., and that means it's National Family Health History Day as well. So if you have an opportunity with family this holiday to ask them about health history, it's a really great tool to have. And as I said earlier, it's the best genetic test we have. You've got limited time before patients walking through your door where you're going to be disclosing their VUS results. As genetic counselors, we've all been in this situation. You wish you had more time to get on PubMed and start researching the variant. Except now you do with franklin.genox.com/DNA today. Franklin uses advanced AI and big data to pull together information on a variant. It's really organized, so you can scan quickly to find what you need. There are even assessment tools to help with this process. It also features real-time reanalysis, which means you have the option to follow a variant and be notified by email for any new evidence that could lead to a classification change. So no more checking back every 6 months. If you work with a team, there's a group feature too. You can see each other's comments in the system, and this can be really helpful if you have a second patient later on with that same variant. You see the conversations you had before. So next time you're working on a variant, just Franklin it for free. Again, that's franklin.genoox.com/DNA today. Thanks for listening and join me next time to learn and discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.